Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine speaking with my guest, Meejin Cha, Senior Policy Analyst at Demos and co-author of an important new report called Millions to the Polls, Practical Policies to Fulfill the Freedom to Vote for All Americans. A foundation of our country is that we, the people, elect our representatives in government. By voting, we have a voice in the decisions affecting our lives and our country. Over time, citizens organized and mobilized to expand the right to vote to include more and more of the people, including blacks and women. But there are those who wish to limit access to voting because of their own narrow interests. Some right-wingers realize they can't get majority support for their program or their candidates in a fair contest, so they are deliberately trying to suppress the vote among people of color, low income, and youth. However, there are those who are fighting to keep access to voting for all Americans. These champions of democracy are tracking the state legislatures, which are undermining voter rights, and proposing ways to strengthen our democracy. A new report called Millions to the Polls was released this week by the Demos Research Center, showing the policies and practices that can strengthen protection for voter rights. Here to talk with us about this new report is co-author Meejin Cha. Meejin Cha is a senior policy analyst at Demos, focusing on money in politics and ideal elections. While at Demos, she also worked on promoting alternative metrics to GDP for measuring progress and broader issues of sustainability. Ms. Cha's research and writing includes work on sustainability policies, green economy, environmental justice, and economic justice. She has written for various outlets, including The American Prospect and The Huffington Post. Ms. Cha is a graduate of Cornell University and holds a JD from the University of California, Hastings College of the Law, and LLM and PhD degrees from the University of London. She is a member of the California Bar and an adjunct professor at Fordham Law School. Meejin Cha, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you for having me.
I was so excited to find out that your report came out because I'm very concerned about what's happening with access to voting for so many of our fellow citizens. Could you tell us just briefly, you know, what is the current situation with some people trying to suppress the vote, and what's happening and how bad is it?
Sure. I mean, you definitely see an assault on the right to vote. Starting from the Supreme Court, you know, their decision in Shelby County, you know, really kind of took away a lot of protections that were increasing the right to vote for people of color, particularly in areas that have historically disenfranchised these populations. To, as you mentioned in your introduction, to state houses, where you see the introduction of really restrictive voting laws like photo ID requirements, and even small things that I think are not getting the attention that they deserve, but have really, you know, a pretty big impact, like restricting the period in which people can vote before Election Day, and taking away the ability to register and vote at the same time. So you really do see kind of a full-scale assault on the right to vote.
And which states do you think have made it difficult for the citizens to vote?
I mean, you kind of see a little bit everywhere. You know, Pennsylvania just passed a restrictive photo ID law that thankfully got struck down. Last session, North Carolina unfortunately rolled back a lot of their voting laws, almost all of which were very successful. Among them, they, you know, rolled back the pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds. They eliminated same-day registration, where you can register and vote at the same time. But you see this happening in state houses across the country.
So is it regional? Like, is this more of a problem in the South, or is it really everywhere?
You know, I wouldn't restrict it regionally. And there are lots of states that are trying to do great things, like Oregon is trying to get automatic registration, and there are, you know, California is expanding their registration and voting, access to voting. So I wouldn't say that it's restricted to just one region, but it is certainly a problem that is prevalent nationwide.
And what are some of these roadblocks that voters are coming up against?
You know, one of the most common ones is registration. You know, registration deadlines are often very arbitrary, and they occur anywhere between 30 days to before election day to just a few days before election day. And a lot of registration applications are still being inputted by hand, so there is a huge margin of error. And often people don't understand that there's a problem with their registration until they show up to vote. And if you don't have a way by which you can fix registration, like something like same-day registration, then you have to vote on a provisional ballot, and that's where roadblocks start, and disenfranchisement can be a real concern.
And how many of our fellow Americans do you think are affected by this kind of new push to limit access to voting?
I think I would say millions of them.
And do you think it would, in some cases, actually affect the outcome of elections?
I mean, you know, it's hard to say. These are always correlation versus causation problems. But, you know, if you think about people who are disenfranchised, and then you think about, you know, races that have been really close with very small margins of win, you know, by which people win, it's hard to say that it's not impacting the electoral outcome.
Right. And in terms of the registration, I can understand why some people might think that voter ID laws are a way to ensure that only legitimate voters are casting ballots. Why are voter ID laws harmful to the democratic process?
Well, you know, you already have to show identification to register to vote. It's a common misconception that you can just show up and register, right? So these laws that they're passing that require things like photo identification, one, it's a big fiscal burden for the state because the state has to provide these IDs for free, otherwise they become a de facto poll tax. And two, you know, there are still, I think it's somewhere up to 10 to 11% of our population does not have a federal issued photo ID. So these are not small populations that don't have access to this kind of identification, and it really serves no purpose other than to be burdensome on the state and burdensome on the voter.
You don't think it serves a purpose of making sure that whoever's showing up is the person they claim to be?
You know, the right has been very successful in pushing this image of voter fraud, but it's a problem that is virtually non-existent.
How many cases of voter fraud were there in the last election?
I don't know the exact number, but it's something like like a fraction of 1%. And I think there have been close to zero successful prosecutions.
Right. So it seems to me you're talking about, on the one hand, a fraction of 1% where there might be a problem of someone voting under someone else's name versus the certainty that we have millions of our fellow citizens who are now having restricted access to voting because of these new laws. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
So the problem isn't so much voter fraud. The problem is these onerous new laws that are being put in place to restrict voting by Americans.
I would certainly say the harm to our democracy is through these overly restrictive voting rights, for sure.
And who do you think is behind the push for these new laws? Is ALEC behind this, the right-wing think tank, think and do tank, or where's this push coming from? Because this is kind of fairly recent in the past several elections, isn't it?
You know, ALEC has definitely pushed photo ID laws. You know, we're nonpartisan, so the issue is more the problem of these laws existing. And I think, you know, people who are in power want to stay in power. And often when you have a really engaged democracy, there is no guarantee that you'll be able to stay in power unless you try to change the rules once you're in office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it seems to me, looking at this, that there are people who have certain program or candidates that they want to win, but they don't think they're going to win in a fair contest. So they feel in order for them to have a chance of winning, they have to suppress the vote. Do you think that's a proper analysis or not?
I think so. I mean, I think, again, people who are in power want to stay in power and will do whatever it takes to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the same time, there are great advocates for voter rights, like, you know, John Lewis and people who really want to expand the right to vote. So I think that it is a segment of people who are really intent on disenfranchising certain populations, And I think the fact that so much money is able to infiltrate our electoral and political process makes the situation worse.
So how did you come to be aware of this and come to write this report, Millions to the Polls?
You know, Millions to the Polls is actually taking kind of what's already happening and what's already working and putting it all together in one place. So none of these ideas are new. They're all very practical, and they've all been proven to work in increasing voter turnout. So for us, it's our positive affirmative voting agenda in ways that states and localities can improve their voting systems.
And you say in this report there's 16 policies and practices that we can follow that will help to strengthen access to voting by legitimate voters. What are some of those policies and practices?
Mm-hmm. So we break the report into three different sections. The first focuses on expanding and streamlining voter registration. And these are things like same-day registration, pre-registering 16 and 17-year-olds, doing voter registration drives in communities. Then we have a segment of recommendations that are around what we call making voting work, to make Election Day and leading up to Election Day work so that as many votes as possible can be counted. And under this section, we have things like early voting, so that Election Day is the last day, not the only day where people can vote. And we talk about things like standardizing poll worker training and recruitment, and simple things like ballot design, making sure the ballots are clear and straightforward, and also making sure that partisan politics are removed from election administration. And the last section looks at what we call protecting and counting every vote, and this is making sure that we don't disenfranchise any eligible voter. Starting with restoring the right to vote for people who have been convicted of a felony, to making sure that deceptive practices and intimidation don't occur at the ballot, and that people who are disabled or who speak another language besides English can still have access to ballots.
Mm-hmm. That sounds pretty comprehensive.
It is.
And I noticed that you put the streamline the voting registration as first. Do you think that's the most important?
I think, you know, the number one indication of voter turnout is voter registration. So high voter registration rates often result in high voter turnout rates. So we really see registration as the key to increasing voter turnout.
Very good. And how are we doing on voter registration? And do you have the information kind of nationwide of the eligible voters in the country? What percentage of eligible voters are currently registered?
It's somewhere around, and I think in the high 60s. But there are differences based on income. So high-income voters are registered to vote at pretty high levels, usually above 80%. But then you see low-income voters are registered to vote at much lower rates, often just barely above 50%.
Did you say 15%?
50. 50.
50. Okay, that's not so bad. And how are we doing in terms of people showing up? Like, what's in the last presidential election here, 2012, what percentage of eligible people voted? Not what percentage of registered, but what percentage of eligible voters actually went to the polls?
You know, unfortunately, I don't have that number in front of me either. I think it was somewhere in the 60 percentile range, somewhere on there, in the 60s.
60, yeah. It might have been 60% of registered voters. But I think it's probably down more like 33 or 35% of eligible voters. It's shocking to me. You know, voting is free power, and it's the way we have a say in what's happening in our country and picking the people who are making these important decisions about how we're taxed, how we're regulated, where our money goes. And it amazes me in talking with people the vitriol they have for Congress and even some of their local officials. And then you ask them, well, you know, did you vote in the last election? And they sheepishly say no. But it seems to me people, if they're going to be complaining, should, you know, get in and do what they can in terms of voting before they're allowed to complain.
I agree. I think it's one of the strongest, if not the strongest, tool we have in our democracy.
Right.
And if you think about the number of people who are so intent on taking away the right to vote, to me it just shows how powerful the vote is, that they're working so hard to take it away.
Right, exactly. If it weren't so powerful, they wouldn't be bothering trying to limit it.
Exactly.
So we've talked some about the voter registration. And what about the making vote? Oh, I have to tell you, before we leave voter registration, I was actually doing a voter reg drive once and talked to this fellow and asked him if he was registered, and he said no. I said, well, why not? It's free power. You're giving away your free power. And he said, well, I tried voting. It doesn't work. I just thought, wow, I was just done. You know, well, it could be on that particular issue or that particular candidate, you didn't marshal enough support to win, but that just means you need to work harder next time. It doesn't mean you should give up on voting.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
So let's talk a little bit about the second part of your report, mm-hmm. making voting work. So what do you think about this early election stuff? I mean, I grew up at a time when everything was oriented for election day, and I've run campaigns as campaign manager, and it was just everything was all about election day. Now we've got the early voting. Is that shown to be something that actually encourages more people to vote? Because it's not like if it's raining on that Tuesday, you're not going to go, but you have more opportunities to vote. So I would think that it has lifted voting participation. Has that, in fact, been the case where early voting has been tried?
It has been the case. They find a 14-day window does increase turnout. And if you think about it, you know, the reason why election day is on a Tuesday goes back to when we were a much more agrarian-based economy. So it made sense based on when market day was. But now, you know, it's really in the middle of the workday, and you hear stories regularly of people who have to wait hours to vote. So, you know, you may get some paid time off to go to cast your vote, but it may not be enough. You still have to juggle the responsibilities of if you have childcare or any kind of other family responsibilities. It doesn't really make sense now in our modern society just to have one day that is not on a holiday and not also on the weekend where people can vote.
And how many states have early voting now? Do you know?
I do. There are different forms of early voting. So some states have early voting, or they also have no permanent no excuse absentee voting or absentee voting. But what we found was that I'm just flipping through here. There are 14 states that don't provide for any kind of early voting and require an excuse for an absentee ballot.
Mm-hmm.
So 36 states offer some kind of either early voting or absentee ballot options.
Yeah, I think that absentee ballot thing is good. I know when I was first voting, you really had to go down to the town hall and swear under oath that you were not going to be in the state on election day.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like you said, there's a lot of people who might have childcare issues or job issues, and they really cannot get to the polls when they're open. So you're doing the absentee ballot seems like a very sensible way to expand the franchise and make sure more people can vote. So is it Oregon that has gone totally absentee ballot?
Oregon and Washington have mail-in vote by mail.
Oh, they have. And how's that working out for Oregon and Washington?
It seems to be working really well. They have very high turnout rates that are consistently higher than the national average. And, you know, particularly for states that have ballot initiatives, absentee balloting or vote by mail gives you time to think about ballot initiatives and research them and before you actually vote on them.
Mm-hmm. Right. So Oregon and Washington, the Pacific Northwest is leading the country here in this. What do you think? Should we all be doing the vote by mail?
I mean, I think the best policy is to have as many options possible for everybody, because there are a lot of people actually that are, like you say, connected to the casting of a ballot on election day. And I think the ideal situation would be that you would, you know, have an early voting window, you would have permanent no-excuse absentee, you would have the option for people to vote by mail, or you would have the option for them to show up at a polling place as well, particularly if they have some kind of registration problem, like they've moved since the last election, or they've gotten married and changed their name, making sure that you still make accommodations for those voters.
Right. And what about this ballot design issue? I mean, this came front and center to everybody in the 2000 presidential election with the butterfly ballots mm-hmm. down in Florida. which were, I saw that my father actually voted in that election using those, and he was outraged at how confusing it was and how he just felt that whole election had been, you know, the wrong person was installed into the White House. But how prevalent is it to have ballot design be confusing? I mean, that would seem to me it's not rocket science. Like, why can't we just always have a clear ballot design?
Yeah, I agree. There's no reason why ballots shouldn't be written in a way that's very simple and straightforward. You know, ideally they would have some kind of process by which you could test them with potential voters before election day just to make sure, because, you know, to some it might be clear to some folks and really unclear to others.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we offer the three principles, which are accuracy, so it's quite clear who you're voting for whenever you fill in an oval. Brevity, which is that you have just one contest on each page, and there's only one language per ballot. And then clarity, where it's again clear what you're voting on and who you're voting for.
Well, that seems pretty straightforward. I mean, it's kind of sad that we would need to be saying this. What about the secretaries of state? Are, you know, they're in charge of the elections in every state, right?
Most states, yeah. And I mean, I think they also are suffering because they. Election administration is consistently underfunded. So I would say that they're trying to do the best that they can with limited resources. It's just that we don't invest as much as we should in our democracy.
Mm-hmm. But didn't Congress, back after the Florida debacle in 2000, Congress passed a law and billions of dollars to fund our election system. So they have money, but they put it into the electronic voting machines, which then the next election we had problems with them.
Even HAVA is still at this point about 12 years old,
mm-hmm.
so it's something that you have to continuously fund on a regular basis. It's not just a one-time
mm-hmm.
expenditure.
Right. And I, from what I saw, I haven't read the whole report. I think it's, what, 92 pages long and just came out. But I don't see an area that you don't address particularly the electronic voting machines and their authenticity, do you?
It's not something that we recommend, so no.
You don't recommend that the electronic voting happen?
We talk a little bit about online registration, but we don't really talk about electronic voting.
Mm-hmm. Are you concerned at all about the design of the electronic voting machines and the accuracy of their voting?
I think, you know, if you think about what we could do to ensure our electoral system functions at its highest level, the way that we ballot design a simple ballot is the way that we would recommend. So we don't really talk about electronic voting.
Yeah. Well, I know it was a big push to have voter-verified paper ballots. So when people are voting, I mean, I was working on the Kerry Edwards legal team in Southwest Florida when John Kerry was running for president, and you know, there's the traditional concern of the things we've been talking about, access to the ballot, trying to depress the vote. We actually had things going on like Republicans were putting out flyers that would say that Democrats vote Wednesday, Republicans vote Tuesday, so that the Democrats would show up the day after the election was over. You know,
right.
Silly stuff like that, but it actually impacts people, and they were doing things like in the low-income and African-American communities, they would be shifting the signs, so it was confusing people about where their poll sites were.
Right.
And, you know, there's always some of that because there are genuine changes, but then there's the mischief that goes on, and I just, you know, at one level, it feels like it's high school hijinks and just kind of silly stuff to be doing, but at the same time, this is serious business. This is disenfranchising people who are legitimate voters, and they should be able to vote, but they're being locked out of the process by scare tactics or by maneuvers that rob them of their rights as citizens, and then we end up, it can affect the election. We get the wrong people in office.
Absolutely, and one of my colleagues released a report on these deceptive practices called Bullies at the Ballot Box that highlights, you know, some of the worst practices, and you're right, it is deceptive and it is deliberate intimidation.
Yeah, And we were getting calls then because the Florida was using the electronic voting machine. We were getting calls all day long saying, I just voted and I voted for John Kerry, but the machine showed that I voted for George Bush. Did I actually vote for Bush?
Right.
And people were horrified because they were so eager to get a new president in, and they went to the trouble of voting, and here was their chance, and instead of voting for the person they wanted to replace, they voted for the incumbent, and they were just really upset about this situation. So I think there's a lot to be concerned about with those electronic voting machines. And from there, there was a push to have the voter verified paper ballots, which then if there's a question about it, you can go back and check.
Mm-hmm.
If you think, well, there's concerns about was my vote recorded properly, then you have for the whole voting site, you've got it on paper. You say, yes, I voted for John Kerry or I voted for George Bush, whoever you voted for. I mean, it's not so much who wins, it's to make sure that the people that are elected as our leaders are the ones that the citizens choose as our leaders. So I think that voter verified paper ballots is a good way to go.
Absolutely.
So now the third section you talked about is about protecting and counting every vote, which is sort of what we're talking about with these voting machines. Is there anything we need to know on that? Like what are you concerned about there?
Well, restrictive photo IDs, like we talked about, is something we're really concerned about. And then also provisional balloting. So if you show up at a poll site and you're not on the voter list, you can vote by provisional ballot, but provisional ballots have a high rate of either not being counted or being people who are otherwise eligible not being able to vote on a proper ballot. So again, simple fixes like same-day registration would eliminate the need for a lot of provisional balloting. And we also want to make sure that people who are formerly incarcerated have their right to vote restored. And I think that's really important, particularly if you think about disproportionate impacts and millions of otherwise eligible voters not being able to vote and not being able to kind of participate fully in their communities and society.
Right.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
And we're also concerned about voter list maintenance and what you're talking about with deceptive practices and just challenging voter eligibility generally. There were a lot of stories from the last election of intimidation groups kind of going up and challenging voters that were otherwise eligible. And, you can't really quantify the impact that has, but it certainly does intimidate people and, in the worst case scenario, makes them not want to vote.
Great. Well, we're going to need to pause now for our network break. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, Mijin Cha, Senior Policy Analyst at Demos, focusing on money and politics and elections on All Together Now. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain, speaking with my guest, Mijin Cha, Senior Policy Analyst at Demos and co-author of a new report, Millions to the Polls, Practical Policies to Fulfill the Freedom to Vote for All Americans. Just before the break, we were discussing efforts to suppress some people from voting and what we can do about it. Ms. Cha, I'd like to know what of this list of 16 policies and practices that could be followed to strengthen the right to vote, what would you say are the top three things we can do to protect the right to vote?
Only three?
Your top three. We can talk about more.
I would say definitely same-day registration. We see this is, again, a time-tested solution. It's been, it's not even something that's only done in blue states. It's was pioneered by states like Wyoming and Idaho and Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin. And it just fixes a lot of problems that can be easily fixed just because people move or they change, they get married and have to change their name. So I really see same-day registration as should be one of our top priorities. I also think getting nonpartisan election administration is also really important. You know, a lot of times, as we saw in both Florida and Ohio, political people get into these positions and they often become, either they're appointed through a partisan process or they're actually elected officials. And I just think when it comes to something like election administration, that of anything should be completely nonpartisan. And then I guess I think we should have really strong protections and also penalties for people who engage in deceptive practices, intimidation, who then result in disenfranchising eligible voters.
Yeah. Well, you know, it sounds so sensible and so clinical when you talk about it, but, you know, yes to same-day registration. Obviously, why we don't have it is amazing to me, and I'd love to see it in all 50 states. In terms of getting nonpartisan election administration, most people think that's what we have. But you mentioned in Florida and Ohio, I think it was when George Bush was going to be elected in Ohio, the Secretary of State, what's his name, Secretary of State Black?
Blackwell. Kenneth Blackwell.
Blackwell. And he was actually the chair of George Bush's election committee in the state of Ohio, and he's supposed to be overseeing a nonpartisan counting of the votes. I mean, it just seems like such a flagrant disregard for, you know, sensibility around having nonpartisan presiding over of the collection and counting of the votes. It's astounding that that was legal and he got away with it. And as it turned out, that Ohio turned out to be such a pivotal state in terms of deciding which way that presidential election went. Why is it even legal that you could have someone who is the chair of someone's election committee actually overseeing the counting of the votes?
I mean, it's not even just the counting of the votes. Election administrators decide where polling places are. You know, they do ballot design. They decide what kind of materials are available at the polling place. I mean, it's every aspect of our elections.
Mm-hmm.
And they should absolutely not be elected or even partisan nominated through a partisan process. And I think you're absolutely right that not many people realize this. And it's such a conflict of interest, and it just shouldn't occur. And Catherine Harris, likewise, was, I think, also co-chair of the re-election committee for George W. Bush. And Florida was a disaster, and, you know, we all know what happened.
Right. Yeah. So is there a way, maybe we should pass a law to make that illegal? I mean, it just seems like common sense that it should be illegal. But
well, Wisconsin has a really great model for their election administration, and it's completely nonpartisan, and they just did a big study of it. We talk about it in the report, and it showed that it really is nonpartisan. They pass, you know, they make decisions that anger both parties and also are in favor of both parties and kind of really focus on election administration. And Wisconsin has very high turnout rates.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And, you know, we love Wisconsin. It's that good, sensible Midwest administrative fairness, and I'd love to see more of that happening around the country. What can our listeners do? I mean, we're hearing this. We know how important it is to make sure that everybody who's eligible to vote is allowed to vote and their votes are counted fairly.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels like something that if you're Secretary of State, you've got control over, but the average listener really doesn't have too much influence on. So what can our listeners do to ensure that all eligible voters have access to their ballot and the ballot is fairly counted?
Well, actually, I think they can do a lot. One, they can vote, for sure. And two, you know, a lot of these things need to be passed by elected officials either at the state or federal level. And I think, you know, we can tend to get a bit cynical and forget that these people work for us, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think even calling and showing your support for things like same-day registration or early voting periods can really make a big difference. And then also just community education so that people know what their rights are when it comes to being, you know, intimidated or calling, you know, showing that there are deceptive practices and being vigilant about protecting people who are trying to vote.
And do you have a kind of a cheat sheet in your report there for the average citizen? It's like, if you care about this issue, here's what you can do.
We have more of a, it's not so much an action plan as opposed to kind of what good ideas are and what our recommendations are for policies to be implemented.
Mm-hmm. Great. So, you know, we need to get some legs underneath the policies.
For sure.
And who's out there doing some good work? I know ACORN used to do incredible work on voter registration drives and helping to make sure particularly people of color and low-income voters would actually get access. But who's out there doing good work in this area now?
You know, there are lots of great organizations that we partner with. Project Vote is one, the Center for Popular Democracy, the Working Families Party, particularly in Northeast, does a lot of great work in getting people out. And a lot of groups are very local and working on a grassroots basis, and they're doing amazing work. And so I would encourage your listeners to kind of see who's out there, see who's working on getting out the vote and volunteering or seeing how they can help.
That's great. And are you going to post something up on your website, an idea, you know, where people can go for that?
That's a good idea. Thank you.
Yeah. Wonderful. And just so our listeners know, if you're interested in this report and the topic of getting, making sure that our fellow citizens are able to vote, you actually can get this report, Millions to the Polls, for free.
Absolutely.
On the DEMOS website. Which is it? DEMOS.org. Is that right?
Yep, that's correct.
Great. And for our listeners who don't know, could you just say a word? What is DEMOS?
Sure. DEMOS is a national organization that is focusing on ensuring that everyone has equal right to vote and everyone has an equal chance in our economy. So we focus on, we have four work areas that we focus on, increasing upward mobility for all citizens, getting money out of politics, and creating our ID election system, and redefining the role of business in society.
That sounds like quite a lot to do. You must have a busy beehive there.
We're a little busy.
And I noticed your description of your focus at DEMOS is on money in politics and ideal elections. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by ideal elections?
I mean, I think that's kind of the basis of Millions to the Polls, is how do we create our ideal election system? Because I think the one thing that everyone can agree on is what we have now is certainly far from ideal. So, you know, we have a couple of ideas in the report that we call Over the Horizon, which is, you know, once we get our ideal, our election system up and running to its maximum potential and also have our ideal system, we should think about ways to not just, you know, have our current system work, but make our system better, like, you know, universal voting or improving our election funds. You know, just trying to find a way that we have a system that works for voters and not for moneyed interests.
So in your ideal elections, are you going to compile kind of best practices from around the country of what could be done?
Well, that's Millions to the Polls.
So you've already got it.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, you know, I was talking to someone else the other day on this, you know, the problem of death by error in hospitals. And, you know, they had people dying because of some procedures that were or weren't done in hospital. And this organization gathered the 10 best practices from hospitals all across the country and said, if you do these 10 things, you can reduce death by error mm-hmm. in your hospital. So, you know, we can do it to save lives in hospitals. We can do it to save democracy.
Absolutely.
Like, really look at what's needed. And I love that you're taking on money in politics because, you know, the more faint of heart look at that and get cynical and go, why should I even bother to vote? Because there's so much money and I'm not a high donor, so why is any elected official ever going to talk to me? You know, what are you doing about money in politics? What do you think can be done to kind of make sure that citizens' voices are heard equally and we're not all drowned out by the millionaires who are financing these increasingly expensive campaigns?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, the first thing I always say is to vote, because at the end of the day, when you go into the polling place, my vote counts the same as Sheldon Adelson's vote, even though he has more money than I will ever have. So I would say voting is the number one way to combat money in politics. And the second are things that really start to reduce the influence that money has. One thing that we really advocate for is public financing of elections. And we released a report last year on looking at Connecticut's program. And, you know, Connecticut was a state that had a series of corruption scandals, so they decided to adopt a public financing system. They have a really high rate of participation. I think something like 78% of elected officials and all of their statewide elected officials participate in the program. And then you really start to amplify the average citizen's voice, because you, one, depend much more on small donors. So by nature, you have to talk to more people. You have to talk to more constituents. You have to get donations from more people. And then you just become less dependent on the big money to win your election. And the famous example from Connecticut that we kept hearing was that the state had tried for nearly 30 years to get unclaimed bottle bill deposits returned back to the state, and one lobbyist had successfully stopped it every year because people needed, you know, the money from his clients, and he just had that kind of power. And in the first election, after public financing was adopted, the legislature ruled to return that money back to the state, and that money actually pays for their public financing program 2.5 times over.
You're saying they're financing the elections in Connecticut out of the money from the bottle bill?
They are.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great example of how what happens when you can remove money from politics.
Yeah. Now, was that something that your current boss, the president of Demos, is Miles Rapoport? He was once Secretary of State in Connecticut. Was that something he worked on?
You know, Miles has always been supportive, but this is a program that's only been in place, I think, since 2004. And Miles came to Demos, was already at Demos by that time. But same-day registration is something he's been working on for decades, and Connecticut just passed it. I think it was in the last legislative session. So,
all right. Well, it seems to me right there, you know, if you want something clear and direct and simple that we could all do, what about having that be the law in every state, that we finance our public elections with money from our bottle bill?
From our bottle bill or from other, you know, general fund sources, people are somewhat resistant to using taxpayers' money to finance elections, but what we always say is that you pay either way. Either you pay a very small amount to have a democratic process where that amplifies the average citizen's voices, or you pay a lot more through subsidies and corporate giveaways when you have a system that is dominated by money.
Right, absolutely. Well, I think that'd be really important to do. And what's the biggest obstacle to getting the money out of politics?
Well, the Supreme Court is ruled that, you know, money is speech, and also that corporations can be seen as people. And I think that's very difficult. And then there's just so much money now that the affluent and corporate interests really dominate our political and electoral system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's pretty scary. It's just, you know, again, some of this stuff just seems ludicrous, but it is, in fact, what's happening. You said the Supreme Court ruled that, you know, money is speech and corporations are people and entitled to free speech and can spend anything they want. You know, it's just astounding. So if the Supreme Court's saying that, what do we need to do? So we have to move to get a different ruling from the Supreme Court, or how do we handle that?
You know, you'd have to reframe legal jurisprudence kind of in the model of how Brown versus Board of Education overturned Plessy versus Ferguson.
And what does that mean?
You know, you'd have to start growing a body of jurisprudence that would start to challenge that ruling, and then eventually, hopefully, the Supreme Court would overturn their original ruling.
And getting some new Supreme Court justices would help.
Probably, yeah.
And back to your report there, you know, you say in the report, voting should not be a test of endurance or willpower, which is so true. So why is it that the lines for voting are so long in some places?
You know, some of it, I think, again, could be fixed very easily. You know, if you don't actually train your poll workers, it causes, you know, confusion. You know, we talked about election administration and where they put polling places. If you don't have enough polling places, that can also cause lines. If you have a lot of people who have registration problems and you don't have same-day registration, that can also cause a lot of lines. And if you underfund your election system, that's also going to create these really long lines. And it's really remarkable that we as a society don't have, like, collective outrage that people have to wait hours just to vote.
Yeah. It's, you know, you look at it and go, well, these were the lines we saw, remember, in South Africa when
exactly
they moved and finally got rid of that heinous apartheid regime, and everyone could vote, and we saw people in these very long lines, first time in their lives they could vote. People waited for hours to go. You know, you just have tears about the testimony to the drive to people to have a voice in the system that is governing them. So you kind of understand it the first time a country has actually ever had real democracy where, you know, everybody could vote, not just the whites,
right,
a certain elite. But we've had democracy here. We've, you know, the women got the right to vote back in the 1920s, so we're heading on to almost like 100 years.
Right.
We should know what to expect. I mean, this is no big surprise. You know, every 2 years we have an election for Congress, and every 4 years that, you know, also we have the election for president. There's lots of state and local elections. We're having elections all the time. And it's no big surprise that people actually turn out to vote. So this should, again, should not be rocket science. You know, why don't we know how much it costs? Why aren't we funding it? And why aren't the people who control those funds setting up the machines and the operations in a way that accommodates people who want to vote?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, if you think about media narratives, say, you know, it's the grandmother that waited for 8 hours. It's like, wow, she, you know, she's so dedicated versus this is completely ridiculous that this woman had to wait for so long to vote. And I, you know, I would just say again, when people are in power, they want to stay in power. And sometimes when people vote, it's scary and it's, you know, there is a high probability that you won't stay in power. So I feel like, you know, we as a citizenry have to really demand these things constantly and be vigilant about making sure that our elections are fair and that they belong to the citizens and not to special interests.
Absolutely right. And how did you personally get into this whole area of work?
Well, you know, I came to Demos to do alternative metrics work, and then we kind of did some strategic planning around how to be most effective, and it really seemed that increasing access to our democracy and access to economic growth were kind of the pinpoint policies that we should focus on. So and elections obviously are really kind of the foundation of all democracy, and I feel like we should have collective outrage that people are working so hard to strip away the right to vote, which so many people have fought so hard to gain.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that elections are so critical to our democracy, and without fair elections, we just don't have a democracy.
Amen, sister. Very well said. And by the way, I love the work that you had been doing there on the, you know, the measuring the GDP and what are real measures of our economic progress. But I think you're absolutely right in your strategic planning process. However you did it, you came to the right place, which is to say, no matter what your position is on any particular policy or issue, and yes, we could do a lot of things differently and better in terms of any issue, whether it's the environment or the economy and all of that good stuff, but what underlies all of that is the vital importance of citizens having a voice in choosing the people who make these decisions on a daily basis on how we live and how we're governed and how we're taxed. And when you see the extent to which millions and millions of our fellow citizens are being denied that right to access, it's very scary. And, you know, you combine that with the money and the politics and the influence of the very wealthy, you really get scared for our democracy. And I agree with you, you know, we should have a collective outrage that there is this really systematic campaign to strip away the right to vote for millions of our fellow citizens. So I really appreciate you doing this report and appreciate guiding us on telling us what we can do about it.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah. And before you go, I know you had done some work in Nepal. Can you just, did you grow up in the United States?
I did.
You did. Mm-hmm. And so how did you end up in Nepal?
A friend of mine from graduate school was working out there, and they had a project on increasing access to justice in the what they call the Hindu Kush Himalaya region, which is the 8 countries that are in the Himalayan mountain range. So I went to try to work with communities to increase access to environmental justice.
They have problems of environmental justice in Nepal?
very much so. They, you know, not surprisingly, access to natural resources is not equal amongst people.
Mm-hmm.
So we worked with local communities to kind of see what their needs were, what challenges they were facing, and how we could kind of build capacity and train people and that so that they would know their rights and also to kind of think about steps forward and how they can protect their own community.
Mm-hmm. Right. And did you stop by Bhutan while you were in the area?
I very unfortunately was not able to do so, but I've heard really amazing things about it.
Yeah, I actually talked to several Bhutanese. I think they're the only ones I know which really have done significant work on this, developing new measures.
Oh, yes, gross national happiness.
Gross national happiness. Mm-hmm. So, and just give us a word on that. Like, what do you think, you know, explain, first of all, for people who don't know, you know, why we need to shift a measure from our gross domestic progress as the one product as the measure for our economy into gross national happiness. Like, explain what that mm-hmm. is and what
sure.
needs to happen in that arena.
So right now, our, you know, GDP is a really rough estimate of what they count as economic growth, but there are a lot of things that are not counted that kind of impact people on a, not on, just on a day-to-day level, but on a well-being level. So, for instance, if you buy a second house, that's counted in GDP the same as if a family is able to buy their first house, even though in terms of what it means for economic upward mobility, the two things are very different. Likewise, you know, if you stay at home to raise your children, that doesn't count to GDP, but if you hire someone as a caregiver, that counts as GDP. And what it does is it starts to distort our policymaking. So, you know, there's really no incentive then to help people stay at home and be caregivers because it doesn't count in our GDP, which has been substituted as our measure of economic growth and subsequent progress. Also, for instance, let's say if all the fish in the world were caught in 1 year, you would see global GDP skyrocket. But, you know, that would be devastating for both fishing communities and also for our sustainable planet going forward, and that's not really reflected. So what Bhutan has is called gross national happiness, and they kind of, you know, people kind of deride it because it has happiness in it. But what it really does is think about, you know, when we think about policies and implementing government ideas, do they increase people's well-being or do they make, you know, make things harder for folks? So, for instance, you know, when they talk about maternal prenatal care, that increases happiness because it decreases maternal mortality and, you know, endangered childbirth. So it's just a way of thinking about, like, what do we value as a society? Do we value just money and just, you know, if one person has all the money, do we think that's as good as if everybody has a healthy standard of living? Or do we value, you know, personal well-being, community growth, community strength? And if so, we need to have measures of progress that start to reflect that. The easiest example, I think, for people to understand is the environment. So, you know, when you think about things like coal plants and all that, they don't take into consideration the environmental damage that they do when they think about things like what they contribute to the economy. So who pays for those, for the polluted air and water, and who pays for the health damage to the communities? That is never really reflected in GDP.
Right, that's good. And, you know, we've got all the initiative to move to true costing where, you know, whatever the use of the natural resources, the, you know, the air, the water, whatever minerals, and also the pollution that's generated, you know, how do we deal with that? That we absolutely have to move to true costing to give the right signals to resource use. So if people are trying to do stuff, you can do it in a way that minimizes the damage, because right now, you know, it's all the damage is borne downstream by next generations who don't have access to the minerals, who are dealing with the pollution fallout from those measures. So, well, you're doing critical work, and I am so grateful for the work you are doing, and I'm very grateful that you took the time from your busy life to talk with us. And for our listeners, the report is available. It's Millions to the Polls, Practical Policies to Fulfill the Freedom to Vote for All Americans. It's available for free at the website demos.org, and we hope to track your future work.
Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Next week, my co-host Charlene Spretnik will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.